Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 17th of June. We're going to talk about red states and blue states and perhaps changing the electoral map this first hour of today's program. Our guests are Alan Abramowitz, who is a professor of political science at Emory University, specializes in American politics, political parties, elections, and voting behavior, and current research involves party realignment and its consequences for presidential and congressional elections. Nicole Mello is also with us, author of The State of Disunion, Regional Sources of Modern American Partisanship. Nicole is an assistant professor of political science at Williams College. Both campaigns have been predicting that they're going to steal states that have been in the other party's column in recent elections. And early analysis suggests there will be new battlegrounds added to the map this year. The route to the necessary 270 electoral votes, starting with holding for Obama every state won by Kerry in 2004, and then focusing on some red states that Obama advisors think they can get. The Kerry map gives Obama 252 electoral votes to pick up the next 18 he will be targeting, although his campaign is in all 50 states, Iowa, Virginia, North Carolina, New Mexico, Nevada, and Colorado. The list also includes Ohio, where he lost the primary to Clinton, but in those 2006 midterms, they shifted fairly dramatically toward the Democrats. McCain has a potential appeal to independents and some Democrats, and he hopes to turn out voters who would not normally be Republicans and to tap potential divisions within the Democratic Party by aggressively, and we've already seen this happen, targeting disaffected Clinton supporters. So we look at all of this hour and welcome your phone calls as we always do. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. And the email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Just a request for you. I've been realizing in the last few days some of the emails that you send are pages long, and I can't get to them on my screen, so if you can make your emails rather succinct, that would be helpful to John Treader, our on-air producer, and to me so that we can get to them. All right, let's go. Professor Nicole Mello, who is the author of The State of Disunion, we thank you very much for being with us. Hello.
Good morning. Thank you so much for the opportunity to join you.
Yeah, we're happy to have you here. Also, Professor Alan Abramowitz, thank you so much for being with us. Are you there?
Yes, I'm
here. Oh, good, good. And welcome to you. Thanks very much.
Glad to be with you.
So just let's get an overview of what's going on in 2008. Are we looking, Professor Mello, at a potential total upset in the way states have and regions have traditionally voted?
You know, it's really anyone's game this year, I think. I say that part of what's been going on, although red states and blue states really came to public attention, I think, in 2000 when the media really noticed what was going on. But this is something that's been building for a long time, two or three decades at least. So there's a certain amount of entrenchment, and you see this both in terms of some of the regularities of presidential election outcomes, but also in congressional delegations, more importantly. But you also have a whole lot that's going on this election that hasn't been going on in the past. You have the issues with the Iraq War, of course. You have a really teetering economy in ways that you haven't had in the past couple of elections. So, and you know, presidential candidates are starting to, I think, really strategically think about how to crack into the other party's regional stronghold. So I think all of this makes it a very exciting election.
Yes, it does. Professor Abramowitz, Obama has pledged to run a 50-state effort. Is that unusual?
It would be unusual if he actually did that. I'm not expecting that to happen. If we look at the electoral map, I think we can say with a very high degree of confidence that we could probably predict right now how about 35 states are going to come out. I personally feel that a lot of the talk about changing the electoral map is overblown.
Hmm.
There will be some changes, but there'll be changes at the margin. In other words, Obama may win some states that went narrowly for Bush in 2004. McCain will mainly be targeting some states that went narrowly for Kerry in addition to the ones that Bush won narrowly last time. So I think ultimately, as the campaign really gets going, we'll see the candidates focusing on a limited number of states, with potentially a few additions from the swing states in 2004.
Mm-hmm.
So we know, for example, that right now Virginia looks like a state that Obama has a good chance of carrying, even North Carolina. As well as, you know, Ohio, which you mentioned, Colorado, Nevada. But for the most part, these are states that went for Bush by a fairly narrow margins last time, except for Virginia, which was, I think, about 8 points. I really don't think we're going to see a total reshaping of the electoral map. And the reason we're not is because the red and blue division of the country is based on sort of underlying partisan divisions of the electorate. And those, you know, don't change that dramatically over a relatively short period of time. So there may be some shifting, but not a total change.
Mm-hmm. There's been some attention paid to the Midwest, and let me ask both of you this, because being from Wisconsin, it's hard for me to understand how Wisconsin went strongly, and we just had a poll released this week, a couple days ago in Wisconsin, showing that Obama is significantly ahead of McCain, and this is considered sort of a swing state. How is it that there are certain parts of the country, Nicole, like Wisconsin, that are, you know, blue-collar working towns where a lot of industry has left overseas? We see such complete differences between what happened here and what happened in Ohio, which isn't all that different a makeup of a state than Wisconsin.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I think part of what Obama, as the Democratic candidate, will have to contend with is how to keep what have been traditionally blue states from an economic perspective.
Mm.
Staying solidly blue. One of the things that you saw in recent elections in a place like Ohio was that social issues became, in the last election, there was a lot of effort to target the social conservatism of some voters and to woo them over to the Republican Party. And so when you have instances like that, that becomes a real challenge for the Democratic candidate, I think, to keep what has been traditionally a strong point for the Democratic Party, which is its message about economic opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
So it's this interplay between social and economic issues that I think can make one state fall one way and another state fall.
And what are those social issues?
You know, abortion was sort of one of the big ones that cracked open the Democratic regional strongholds in the 70s and the 80s. That's become, I think, slightly less resilient in recent years as issues like gay marriage have captured attention. A whole host of kind of related issues around family and gender relations have come into play in recent elections in ways that I think really have made Democrats struggle to find a message that keeps all of their constituencies, both their socially liberal, socially progressive, as well as their economically progressive constituents together on the
mm-hmm.
same page.
Is this, though, such a different year, do you think, Professor Abramowitz, with the war in Iraq and so many people unhappy, with a huge number of people who are unhappy with the Bush administration, with the economy being in turmoil, with the price of gas being so high? Does it put all of those issues that Nicole mentioned really on the back burner this year?
Well, I think it does to a certain extent. There's no question that the national political environment this year is very different from what it was 4 years ago or 8 years ago. The level of discontent in the electorate, the desire for change in direction for the country, the president's very, very low approval ratings, the worries about the economy, and, of course, concern about the war, I think, are shaping the political environment this year in a way that really should be very favorable for Democratic candidates from the top to the bottom. And we're seeing that in reflected in the polling on the congressional races this year, where Democrats seem to have significant advantage and are likely to pick up seats in both the House and Senate. And in questions about the generic ballot, when people are asked, you know, would you rather have a Democrat or Republican, the generic Democrat has a big lead. when people are asked specifically about Obama versus McCain, you get a much closer race. And I think that reflects the fact that some uncertainty about Obama on the part of some Democrats, but also the fact that that McCain is still seen to some extent, I think, as a different kind of Republican, as a moderate, someone who's had a reputation in the past, at least as a maverick. And, you know, that's something I think the Obama campaign is going to be trying to undermine, because that's really the only thing right now, I think, that gives McCain any chance of winning this election.
Mm-hmm. Nicole, some commentators have said, I'm not sure if this is true or not, that the country is still right of center, and McCain would be much more appealing for ideological reasons, Obama characterized as way off to the left.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure that I agree completely with that characterization. It's true that the way we talk about politics in the last 10-20 years is pretty different from the way that we talked about politics, say, in the 1960s. To take a classic example, Social Security, although it didn't go under anywhere under the Bush administration, was on the table in a very real way, in a way that it would not have been in the 1960s. So I think that that's, I guess my first point would be that it's not. I'm not exactly sure that the country as a whole is still right of center. And the other point is that we've in the past 6 months alone, we've introduced a lot of new and worrying concerns that can shake up that sort of right of center sensibility if it does exist.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, you know, and the most obvious one is the real kind of across the board. Worrisome notes about the economy, the housing slump, the credit crisis, the oil prices. These sorts of things really have traditionally benefited Democrats, hands down, and Democrats are still seen as the best able to deal with economic woes.
Mm-hmm. Ellen, let's go to the Mountain West, which people are describing as the one part of the country that may be changing most politically, a rising Hispanic population, dissatisfaction with Republicans. What about that in the 2008 race? Are you going to be looking carefully at those states?
Oh, absolutely. There's no question there are a number of states in that region that are going to be in play and, you know, contested by both campaigns. And the most important, I think, will be Colorado, New Mexico, Nevada, which were all swing states in 2004 as well. All three ended up being carried by Bush in that election, but New Mexico just barely, and Colorado and Nevada by slightly larger margins. But certainly all three of those states are going to be in play, And a part of that is a reflection of the changing national political climate, but part of it is a reflection of these longer-term demographic shifts that are taking place in that region, and as well as generational differences. But certainly the growth of the Hispanic vote is going to be a critical factor in the voting in those states and the outcome of the election in those states. The Hispanic vote's steadily increasing. In the Mountain West, particularly, and so whichever campaign can successfully woo Hispanic voters is going to have a big advantage. And right now, the Democrats seem to have the advantage there. Hispanics seem to be shifting back to the Democrats from where they were in 2004 when they were a little more Republican than usual.
Mm-hmm. Could you comment on that, please, Nicole?
Yeah, I think that's a great point and a great voting block to pay attention to. I think in 2004, Bush captured about 30% of the Hispanic vote, which is a particularly high number. But, you know, immigration in the past 4 years, the debate over immigration, I think, is really mobilizing the Latino vote. And so you really could see some swings in the West, which has historically been a little bit more of a swing region than some of the other regions of the country. So
mm-hmm.
changing demographics there could really have a huge impact. And I think just to echo the point about the past 4 years and the sort of some of the things that the Bush administration did that I think destabilized the region as a Republican stronghold a little bit. I think one of the really interesting things about the 2006 blue sweep election was that several states in the West were picked up in the congressional elections by Democrats. Colorado was a case in point. They gained sort of majority control there in the Congress. And in part, I think one of the things that became apparent was that issues around civil liberties and the Bush administration's prosecution of the war on terror and the war in Iraq, issues around government debt and deficit spending began to destabilize allegiance to the Republican Party. And what you saw was a shift to independent, but then often voting Democratic mm-hmm. in that election. And I think that portends some change in the Mountain West as well for the future.
Interesting. Let's look at the Appalachian region of the country where Obama did very poorly. Can you explain to me the regional sources of modern partisanship in that part of the country? Is race still a big issue here, or why did he just bomb in that part of the country, and does it make any difference in this general election?
It's a very interesting question. You know, historically, race was one of the arenas that was a source of discontent for Democrats and why the National Democratic Party split regionally in ways that Republicans really benefited. In recent elections, race has not been deployed as much as an issue. You know, there's been a lot of reference back to President Bush's 1988 run against Dukakis and the Willie Horton ad, and that's sort of, I think, in my mind, where you have to go to come up with a sort of recent, very obvious, racially coded effort to win votes. So, you know, I think it may play a factor in a very complicated way. And in an interesting way, Obama's speech on race earlier in the campaign season, I think, highlighted some of the stalemates and discontents that you still see. And I think that there's a worry among particularly working-class whites that Obama will be attentive to their concerns and their economic concerns in a way that really is embedded in deep histories about race and racial conflicts.
Mm-hmm. Alan, your thoughts on this as well, please.
Well, I think that the issue of race is going to have a fairly complex effect on the election. On the one hand, I think that it probably does make it more difficult for Obama in a region like Appalachia, where I do think that the racial attitudes among white voters are still probably somewhat more conservative, and if not outright racist. And I think that was a factor in his poor performance in states like West Virginia and Kentucky, and in some of the other states bordering those states. On the other hand, you know, I think that what we're going to see in November is a very large turnout among African American voters, as well as mm-hmm. Overwhelming support for Obama. You know, even beyond the normally very strong Democratic support among African American voters. So that's going to be a plus for Obama. And in addition, I think Obama as not just an African American candidate, but as a biracial candidate, and a candidate with this very, very unusual background, you know, having grown up outside of the United States for part of his life, I think that in part explains some of the appeal that he has to some more educated white voters, and particularly to younger voters. I think the voters under the age of 30, particularly, are going to be a crucial constituency for Obama and for the Democratic Party in this election. They're already disproportionately Democratic
right.
Voting group, and I think they're likely to play an important role in the 2008 presidential race.
And will they vote in large numbers, do you think, Nicole?
That's the million-dollar question. There's been great expectation for young voters. Going back to the early 1970s when the voting age was lowered to 18, I think, you know, speaking personally, I've seen more excitement and mobilization among students and young voters than I have in past elections. So this could be the election that changes things. I do think that Obama represents a voice that not only offers change, but change in the tone of politics that they've really grown up with. I mean, they've come of age in a very partisan era. So I think regardless of policy stances and issues and, frankly, ideological commitments, all of the things that were just said by Professor Abramowitz about what Obama brings to the table, in addition to his sort of anti-partisan rhetoric, could really appeal to young voters.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think the other thing we have to keep in mind is that young people are one of the most economically vulnerable segments of the population. They are less likely to have health insurance. Their incomes are relatively low, and so I think that they are affected more by the downturn in the economy than even the older people are. And so I think in that sense that they are attracted to the Democratic message. And we already saw an increase in turnout among young people and actually across the board in 2004. Voter turnout was up considerably compared with the 2000 election. And, all the preliminary indications that we have are that interest in the 2008 election is even higher than it was at this time before the 2004 election. So I think we're going to see a high turnout across the board, including among younger voters.
Mm-hmm. Phone calls for both our guests in just one moment. Here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. Email is talk@WPR.org. We're looking at all 50 states, looking at what red states Democrats have a chance to win this November. We're looking at different regions of the country, and one of our guests has written a book on regional sources of modern American partisanship. Are some of those areas of the country changing? If so, what areas and why are they changing? We're looking at the campaign strategies of both candidates. What about those people who supported Hillary Clinton? Will many of them be moving to Senator John McCain, who's been courting them in many speeches in the last week or so? We welcome your thoughts on this. Our guests are Professor Alan Abramowitz, who's a professor of political science at Emory University, specializing in American politics, political parties, elections, and voting behavior. And his current research involves party realignment in this country and its consequences for presidential and congressional elections. Professor Nicole Mello is the author of The State of Disunion, Regional Sources of Modern American Partisanship. She's an assistant professor of political science at Williams College. To your calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now and start our calls with Mark from Viroqua. Hi, Mark.
Hello. Good morning. Thanks for taking my
sure.
call. My comment and hope for stirring some discussion is that the who occupies the Oval Office is less important than the American people speaking up firmly and loudly, because there's such incredible vested interest from corporations for things to remain the way they are. Big business is not going to go quietly into the night, and big business is driving this country down. For example, there has been no one in memory who has ever deserved more impeachment more than George Bush. And yet, Washington is at a standstill about this issue because they're afraid of losing elections, et cetera, and our Constitution has been raped. I just was listening to an earlier program around 7:30 where there was somebody on from Cato and talking about the need to drill in the U.S., and he made some valid points, but there are so many issues that aren't even being discussed and thinking outside the box. And, I think Obama represents our best opportunity for change, but there's an incredible amount of inertia in Washington, and unless we get people saying no, an oil-based economy is not going to work. We really have to move forward. And even if we go through a period, Americans have to recognize that we're going to go through a period of time that's going to be uncomfortable and is going to be less prosperous, but we can come through this to a point where it is a markedly better, more equitable society. So anyway, I feel like I'm rambling, so I'll
all right,
get
thanks.
And take my comments
thanks.
Off the air.
Thanks for the call. Alan?
Wow, there's a lot there, but first of all, I would disagree with the opening statement. I think that the person who occupies the Oval Office makes a huge difference because there are a lot of things, as we've seen with the Bush administration, there are a lot of things that the president can do through his appointment power, the kinds of people he puts into office, heading all these various agencies and bureaus within the federal government, where you have a lot of policymaking going on, irrespective of what Congress does. And we've seen, as well as, of course, the president's ability to deploy U.S. Troops overseas, which President Bush, of course, has used very liberally. So that's going to make a tremendous difference. But there's no question that to have any kind of major shifts in public policy, you're going to need to sort of overcome some of the innate inertia that is built into our system of government. It isn't just because of lobbyists and interest groups. It's because our system of government was designed to have inertia built into it, because we have the Congress as well as the president that have to cooperate because of the role of the courts, because of the anti-majoritarian features of the Constitution, and because of the filibuster rule in the Senate, where it for all practical purposes, you need 60 votes in the Senate in order to enact legislation. So there are all those things. And, you know, so a lot will depend on the outcome of the House and Senate elections as well as the presidential elections. But I do think there's a real opportunity if you have a Congress and president controlled by the same party to have some fairly substantial changes made in the direction of national policy, as well as, I said, the many things the president can do through his powers as chief executive, his appointment power, and so on.
Yeah. Well, Nicole, I this isn't fair to ask, but I will anyhow. What do you think the chances are of that happening, of the Democrats taking over everything?
You know, it's a possibility. It's a very good possibility right now. I think the more important question is how long, if that does happen, how long they can sustain it. One of the things that we try to pay attention to is whether elections are what we call deviating elections or if they're real realignments. So a realignment in party control in which the Democrats took over both Congress and the White House and had sort of a unified program that they were trying to implement would really be a shift in American politics in a very substantial way, obviously. If this is just about reaction against the Bush administration, if it's just about dissatisfaction with the particular state of affairs at this moment, we would see a more fickle response, temporary Democratic control that gives way again in 2 years or 4 years to divided control or a reestablished Republican unified government.
Mm-hmm. Let's spend a little bit of time, because certainly McCain is courting the women who voted for Hillary Clinton and have been very upset about this election with charges that she wasn't treated very fairly. There was sexism in this campaign. What are the chances of his being able to woo a lot of those voters? Or do you think they will just go back to the Democratic Party, or maybe they won't vote? What do you think?
Well, I'll jump in on that one. I'm skeptical about that possibility, because what we've seen in past elections is that when you have a fairly divisive primary contest, that initially, at least, some of the supporters of the defeated candidate are reluctant to endorse the winner. But in this case, really the policy differences between Clinton and Obama are fairly insignificant. So this is a different situation from what we saw, with the Democrats back in 1968 or 1972, with the Republicans even in 1976 when Ford was challenged by Reagan, where there were, more significant policy differences. If you think about the kinds of people who are the strongest supporters of Hillary Clinton, I think for the most part they tend to be women who are very liberal, who would probably consider themselves feminist, and it's just hard for me to envision them either voting for McCain, whose record you know, on issues of concern to women, at least feminist women, you know, is he's on the opposite side of almost every issue they care about.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas Obama, you know, is on the on their side on almost all of those issues. So I just, you know, I'm very skeptical about that. And from the polling that we've seen already since Hillary Clinton suspended her campaign, you know, we're seeing for the most part that that these former Clinton supporters, you know, seem to be moving behind Obama. And I think we'll see more of that happening over the next few weeks.
And yet, Nicole, he is praising Hillary Clinton and praising her and praising her in almost every speech.
Yeah. It's just to backtrack for one quick second, I think one of the interesting thought experiments would have been, had Hillary Clinton clinched the Democratic nomination, I think she might have had better success attracting Republican women voters than I think McCain is likely to have with Clinton's female voters, female voting base. But that's just an aside. I think that part of what McCain's strategy might be is to reach out to the voters that Clinton seemed to do well among. This goes back to an earlier question that we were talking about. Places like Pennsylvania and Ohio, where Clinton really fared strongly, did
yes.
quite well, and that are swing states. And I think McCain is trying to reach out to those voters with his praise of her, particularly at this juncture.
Rich from Sullivan, hi.
Hi. I kind of agree with your guests on some things. I was at a wedding over the weekend in Illinois, and so I talked to a lot of my Reagan Democrat relatives, particularly women, and it was in Palos Heights, Palos Hills, Orland Park, Oak Forest area of the south suburbs of Chicago, so it isn't exactly a Democratic stronghold. And speaking with these women, many of them middle-aged to older than middle-aged, they basically were telling me that George Bush had so wounded the Republican Party by promising to be a uniter, not a divider. And one of my cousins said to me, and it's kind of funny, she said, the kind of women who would vote for McCain are the kind of women who, when their husband calls and says they're at a Hooters restaurant and explains that its theme is barn owls and the ecology, that they would accept that explanation from their husband. And I laughed pretty hard at that. The thing I didn't laugh at from your guests is when Alan Avramovitz, I think is his name, I disagree with the idea that we should characterize people who vote with race in mind as conservatives, because my relatives have changed over the years, and they're big sports nuts, and they back a lot of teams that have a lot of players that aren't exactly from the Scandinavian countries or Ireland or Germany. And I don't think race figures at all the way it used to. And I also, you know, have been to weddings in my family where this wasn't one of them, but in many of the weddings there are coworkers who come to these receptions, and they're African Americans mixing with our East European Roman Catholic group, and the only people who are even slightly uncomfortable with it are the really old voters who don't like to see people dancing together, I guess is what I would say. But things have really changed, at least in our family.
How politics have changed through the eyes of my relatives' weddings. You need a piece in the paper somewhere, Rich, to explain that. It's a good way to get popular opinion. Alan, you take it.
Well, I think that's absolutely right, that there has been a dramatic shift in racial attitudes over the last 30, 40 years. And if that had not happened, then a candidate like Barack Obama could never have gotten as far as he has. It would have been unthinkable 30 or 40 years ago, I think, for an African-American candidate to win the presidential nomination of one of the major political parties. So certainly there's been a shift, and I think that's why when we see a certain segment of the electorate in places like West Virginia and Kentucky and maybe some of the other states, you know, who still seem to have some of these negative, hold some of these negative stereotypes, where some degree of racial resentment is still present. You know, it strikes us as, I think, kind of a throwback, as, you know, it surprises a lot of people, I think, to see that those attitudes are still present. But what we have to keep in mind is that we're talking about a fairly small segment of the electorate. And in fact, you know, what the polling suggests right now is that voters are more willing at this point to accept that they have less concern about voting for an African-American candidate than they might have about voting for a woman, or certainly than voting for someone who will be 72 years old mm-hmm. when he assumes the presidency. So that maybe end up being a bigger factor in the voters' decision-making process than race.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. We don't like to talk about that, Nicole, because we baby boomers want to think of ourselves as vigorous into our 90s. But it's interesting among older people that they tend to be less likely to vote for McCain because they see themselves slowing down. Isn't that interesting?
That is a very interesting observation, I think. And it makes something like Florida as a swing state a really interesting place. It's a factor that we haven't considered in when we're talking about swing states in recent elections. Now, I think that McCain still holds a slight lead at, in recent polls in Florida. But the question of his age, and certainly, you know, the question of his age at should he win and should he run for re-election, becomes a factor.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Don from Darlington. Hi, Don.
Hello.
Hello. Go right ahead.
Hi. I had a very short question. I was just wondering, what percentage would a new president need of the Hispanic vote to become president? Because I heard, like, for Bush's last term, they needed somewhere around the area of 30%.
Alan?
There are different estimates of what share of the Hispanic vote Bush actually got in 2004. In the national exit poll, it was up around 43%, but then a lot of people who are experts on the Hispanic politics doubted that. But certainly it was a larger-than-normal share of the Hispanic vote. And it also varied somewhat from state to state and from Hispanic group to Hispanic group. Keep in mind that Hispanics are a very diverse group, and obviously Cuban Americans are very, very different from Mexican Americans or Puerto Ricans and so on. So there isn't any specific number that you can put on that. I think certainly the Democrats would like to see their share of the Hispanic vote move back up to where it was back in, say, 1996 or even 2000, when it was probably closer to about 70% or more. And that's what we saw in the 2006 midterm elections. The Democrats did very well with Hispanic voters. And so far, the early indications seem to be that the Hispanic vote has shifted it back to the Democrats, and I think we'll see Obama do fairly well there, although McCain certainly is making an effort to appeal to Hispanic voters, and his relatively moderate record on immigration, I think, certainly gives him a better chance to win over some Hispanic voters than, say, if the Republicans had nominated someone like Mitt Romney, who had taken a very hard line stand on the issue of immigration. So there will be intense competition for the support of Hispanic voters, particularly in those swing states in the Rocky Mountain region and some other parts of the country as well.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Don, for the call. This one goes to you, Nicole. It is an email. While we may recognize certain historical voting trends, isn't it true that this red state, blue state nonsense started only within the last few election cycles and the divide was created by USA Today and their color graphics and charts?
That's quite a lot of power. You know, it has become, as any political phenomena that gets picked up and relayed throughout the national media does, it starts to take on a life of its own.
Mm-hmm.
I think what is really interesting and quite profound about these regional shifts is that they've been underway for decades, as I said earlier. And frankly, regional politics have, in a two-party system where representation is predicated on geography, it makes a lot of sense. And we've had regional party politics for most of our political history. There have been a few exceptions, and one notable one was in the aftermath of FDR's election in 1932, and the New Deal Democratic Party that he built really spanned many of the traditional regional divides. What I do think you see is an exaggeration of how red some states are or how blue some states are. What we're talking about in many of these instances are relatively close divisions, 10 percentage point divisions. But what you do see consistently across time is that the blue states have continued to send Democrats to Congress. They tend to vote for the Democratic presidential candidate in the same way that the states that we now classify as red in the past 20 and 30 years have increasingly been sending Republicans to Congress and voting for the Republican presidential candidate.
More phone calls for both our guests in just one moment. The number is 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, 414-227-2050. We're talking about several issues. We're looking at, one of our guests has written a book on the state of disunion, regional sources of modern American partisanship, and whether or not that seems to be changing in this 2008 election. We have two guests with us, Nicole Mello, who's author of that book and an assistant professor of political science at Williams College, and Professor Alan Abramowitz is with us, a professor of political science at Emory University. His areas of special interest are American politics, political parties, elections, and voting behavior, and his current research involving party realignment in this country and the consequences for presidential and congressional elections. Our lines are filled. Just keep the number in mind, 800-486-8655. Email is open, and that's talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, the author of Big Man on Campus, a university president speaks out on higher education. Back to phone calls now for our guests, and we go to Roger from Menasha. Hi, Roger.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call, Kathleen.
Sure.
I have two questions. First question is, Barack Obama, being mulatto, do you think that if he was, do you think if he looked more white than black, would race still be an issue? and my second question is, Why are we seeing nothing at all in the media about the Keating 5 deal?
Okay, thanks for your call, Roger.
I think Obama's appearance, I don't think that that's really a big factor here. I think it's pretty well known that his mother was white and his father was African. Or at least it's becoming better and better known, and that really doesn't seem to be a factor. I mean, he has an African American identity. He identifies himself as an African American. He has throughout his political career, and I think that's what's significant. As far as the Keating Five, I think the press is just reluctant to bring up an incident that occurred, quite a long time ago. I just don't think that most voters would consider that very relevant to to their decision in 2008.
Nicole?
Yeah, I agree. I think what we do find in presidential elections is that for a small portion of the electorate, certain things that get attached to the individual person, personality, characteristics, and physical traits can matter. But I think in some ways the more salient one might be questions of vigor. I mean, going back to questions that we've talked about earlier in the hour, issues of vigor and command. You know, the famous televised debate between a young John Kennedy and Richard Nixon. Many people thought that this debate, that Kennedy really benefited from his appearance on television. And so I think these might be the sorts of things that matter it in a very small, I would emphasize to a very small degree for a small portion of the electorate.
Mm-hmm. You know, the thing that strikes me so much is that the differences on these candidates' stands on issues could not be more stark. We've got an election where they have just completely different ideas about virtually everything.
Yeah, that's very true, and that's a reflection, I think, of a trend that we've seen over the last 30 or 40 years where, just in general, the differences between the parties have been getting greater and greater. And we see this in the Congress as well as in presidential campaigns. We've got a party system today that's much more polarized than it was 40 or 50 years ago when there was much more overlap between the parties. There were a lot more moderate Democrats and Republicans, conservative Democrats, liberal Republicans. Those types of politicians are pretty much extinct now. And I think the voters sort of reflect the polarization that's taken place among leaders. They've become more polarized themselves.
Mm-hmm. I agree completely. And I think just to add on to that, although there's a lot of negatives that come with polarization and with the strong disagreement between the parties, rancorous partisanship, there's lots of ways that we describe it in very negative terms. One of the things that it really does is make clear what the differences between the parties are, so that if you're a voter, it doesn't take much to figure out the differences between the two parties and the two presidential candidates on there on the major issues of the day. And that's a really helpful guide for when you walk into the voting booth.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay. Let's go to Don from Sparta. Hi, Don.
Hi. One of the demographic that Obama seems to have the least luck with is the educated or uneducated. And everybody would like to see an intelligent president, one who is thoughtful and able to understand the complexities of the world. Now, how can Obama appeal to the uneducated without dumbing down his campaign? Because there are a lot more uneducated voters probably than there are educated. What's your suggestion?
Well, you know, what's happened over time, of course, the education level of the American electorate has been rising. It's risen dramatically, actually. If you compare the electorate today with the electorate of the 1950s, you know, back then we had a very large percentage of voters who had only a grade school education and only a very small minority who were college graduates. And now we have more college graduates than voters who only have a high school education. So that's been a dramatic shift, and I think it affects the sort of the tone of the campaign and the role that issues play in the campaign as well. So as far as appealing to the less educated, most of the less educated voters, a lot of them are either elderly voters or they're minorities who generally don't continue their schooling as long as for example, whites do. So I think that that's probably more significant than their education level.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call. Email, is it possible this election will have the popular vote go one way and the Electoral College another? It happened recently. I wonder if it will again. Nicole.
Well, what we know from 2000 is that it's always a possibility.
Yeah.
It's hard to have a crystal ball. That would require having a sense of or knowing which states would go which way, really, to know how that would shake out. I think it's happened very, very, very rarely in American history, so it's not likely that it will happen again.
Right, and the thing to keep in mind is that even in 2000, it really shouldn't have happened, and that what really happened in 2000 was less an electoral vote misfire or electoral college misfire than a Florida misfire, because we know, based on the research that's been done on the ballots that were cast in Palm Beach County, where they had the butterfly ballot, that alone, the butterfly ballot cost Al Gore over 10,000 votes in the state of Florida.
Mm-hmm.
So it really should not have happened then, and I'd say it's rather unlikely. If the popular vote margin is more than a point or two, then the chances of an electoral vote misfire are very, very slim. But it could happen, and there's even the possibility of a tie in the Electoral College.
Oh, my gosh.
In which case, the election goes to... The election would go to the House of Representatives,
right?
Voting by state delegation with one vote per state delegation.
Yeah.
So, I think very few people would like to see that happen, other than maybe some historians.
Right. People like you guys. Hasn't this been a year, though? I mean, it's just been so interesting, so interesting.
A fascinating year.
It sure has.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. We have such interesting candidates, the whole Democratic contest, John McCain's, reemergence when everyone thought that his, he was just completely done for. So many things that have been fascinating. And now I think we're going to have a really interesting campaign with, as you said, dramatic differences between the parties on very important issues to the American people,
right.
And a very, very expensive campaign. I think we're going to see a huge amount of money.
Right. We got to end on that. Thank you so much, both of you. It was a great hour. Thanks.
Glad to be with you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we'll have them on again during this season. Alan Abramowitz, Professor of Political Science at Emory University, Professor Nicole Mello, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Williams College, and author of The State of Disunion. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and to John Treader for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios, and thanks everybody for all your great calls. We'll have more following the news on the Ideas Network.